Veterans Day. And this fact was just a few moments ago brought home to me in a very vivid way, in that I had an opportunity to meet somebody who was born in Vietnam at about the same time I was serving there. And so we had some shared experiences that really, you know, we spoke of them and really touched my heart. So, as a Vietnam veteran, I guess I want to say, if you know anyone who is a veteran, please don't wish them a happy Veterans Day. It's not an occasion for celebration. It is an occasion for remembrance. So you may want to say something like, thank you for your service, and peace be with you. And if you happen to know someone who is born into a situation of war and strife, likewise, to simply say, peace be with you. Peace be with you. That living through something like that, you know, when a couple of years ago, I was listening to a program on NPR on Veterans Day, and somebody who was, someone was being interviewed. He was a Navy veteran who happened to be stationed on a ship in Pearl Harbor on December 7th of 1941. And he spent that day in a longboat with others cruising around in Pearl Harbor, picking up injured sailors from the water, many of whom were horribly injured and soon died. And he said, I couldn't tell, and he was in his like late 70s, early 80s. He said, I couldn't tell you half of what I read in today's newspaper. But he said, I will never forget a moment of what happened on that day. Although I wish to God I could. He said, something like that tattoos your soul. So any of us, whether our lives have been touched by war or some other trauma that has shaken us to our core and has caused us to wonder who we really are as humans, and whether it's possible to sustain that kind of experience and still have faith in the possibility of the cessation of suffering. You know, it's a tremendous test of faith. And so, whether it's for those of us who have had the experiences in the past, or many of us may in the future, it's an opportunity to pause and simply have respect for the resilience and the endurance of those of us who, of all of us who either have been or may be part of such events in this world. James?
Yeah, I was a National Guardsman during Vietnam, 70 or 76, so I didn't have to go. And I heard a report the other day about a man who says, please don't thank me for my service. And I think it was because he served in one of the two Iraq wars and or Afghanistan. And I don't know if people in this room know it, but 5 to 10 times as many people who served in those places have committed suicide and were killed in the war. Mm-hmm. So there are no winners in war. War always makes us less human.
No. Janet Rankin, the first woman elected to Congress, once observed, no one wins a war just like no one wins an earthquake. Sun Tzu, one of the masters of military strategy, he was a brilliant military strategist in ancient China, who wrote a famous book that still uses a text at West Point and elsewhere called The Art of War. And his brilliance manifested mostly in his ability to use a smaller military force to overcome a larger one. And in the preface to The Art of War, what he writes is that war is a disaster. War is an example of the greatest of human failings. War is an example of our inability to live together as we should. And this is someone who was a master of war. He was saying, you know, we do this because we have failed at every other possibility in terms of how to live together peacefully. So, yeah, it's obviously it's a time to remember and honor all of those of us who were touched by war, whether from serving in the military or for having been a citizen or of a country that was afflicted by war. But, you know, from the context of the Buddha Dharma, what it's really all about is going back to the roots, saying, what are the roots of the greed, hate, and delusion that gives rise not only to individuals, but to whole societies and whole nations deciding that this is something that's worthwhile to engage in? You know, the better attuned we are to those forces in ourselves, I think the better able we all are to speak out when there is the inclination to enter into armed conflict and say, there must be a better way. So anyway, that's one of the, and interestingly for me, it was coming home with what 14 years later they would start calling post-traumatic stress disorder or post-traumatic stress syndrome, that led me to really on a quest to find a way to heal myself from those effects. And that effect is what brought me to the Dharma. My first retreat, you know, with Jack and Joseph and Sharon in the Redwoods, Mendocino County in 1975. So full circle, okay. So, this evening I want to speak about one of the Buddha's teachings on the subject of impermanence or change. And it was what the Buddha described as one of the three characteristics of existence. One being the fact of the realization, the reality of ceaseless change. Nothing is stable, nothing is permanent. Everything is always in the process of arising and changing and passing away, including us. Second teaching is on the notion of insubstantiality, the things that we consider to be solid and real and permanent, in fact, are not. But they are essentially empty. Empty of substance, because they are all arising and changing and passing away. So the teaching of anicca, impermanence, anatta, insubstantiality, and the realization of those two realities or aspects of being in the human mind from the standpoint of the self, okay, gives rise to the third mark of existence or characteristic of existence, which is dukkha or dissatisfaction. Because the mind imbued with a sense of self is highly dissatisfied with the notion of continuous change and insubstantiality. It's the mind that does not want those first two things to be true. And so, when the Buddha taught about the arising of dissatisfaction and the cessation of dissatisfaction's causes, you know, he was basically saying, you know, the reason, there are several forms of suffering, some having to do with just being in the body, some having to do with being a social being, and the loss of loved ones and whatnot. And the other is the the sense of dissatisfaction or strife that comes from believing that we are a permanent and abiding entity. And then when we have all this evidence to the contrary, ceaseless change, arising, changing, passing away, insubstantiality, that is troubling to the mind because it causes us to fear the cessation of self. The fear of cessation of self comes from a belief in self. Mm-hmm. So, the Buddha said, no self, no problem. and of course, it's somewhat easier said than done, as we know, right? So, so the three marks of existence, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. So one of the ways that our practice of insight meditation, has been described as, you know, once we've gotten beyond the kind of the secular mindfulness meditation benefits of a calmer mind, a clearer seeing and whatnot, is that when we begin to experience the power of mindfulness and the insights that come from it, being able to see into the empty nature of self and the continuously changing nature of self. Okay. That it becomes what, in the Anguttara Nikaya, one of the discourses of the Buddha, he referred to as the deep-hearted embrace of the inevitable.
Say that again.
The deep-hearted embrace of the inevitable. You know, Suzuki Roshi, the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, once observed, he said, you know, life is a little bit like setting out to sea in a small boat that you know is going to sink. It's the wholehearted brace of the inevitable. It's like, gosh, oh, we should have read the fine print before I took delivery on this body. It's like, whoa, this isn't fun anymore, you know? It was in 1975 when my wife Abby and I did our first insight meditation retreat, you know, in this very primitive setting in Northern California with our friends Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg, before there is an Insight Meditation Society and before there was a Spirit Rock. And it was just a bunch of, you know, ex-hippies getting together in the woods and doing this practice that they just brought back from Asia. And so we did that retreat and came back and we realized that it had been utterly transformative, that it was going to be our spiritual path, that we felt like we'd found our spiritual home. And so we were sharing our experience with friends, and one of our friends, we were living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, and one of our friends, when she heard the practice we were engaged in, she said, well, you know, I'd be really careful of that practice if I were you, because it turns out to be extremely destructive of relationships. And so we asked, well, you know, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, we have some friends, a couple who, you know, the husband went off and did one of these retreats, that, like the one you were on, and he came back and decided that that he and his wife really ought to get divorced. He had come to the conclusion that their relationship was not wholesome and shouldn't continue. And so she said, well, if that's the kind of outcome, then, you know, you may want to think twice before you do your next one. Sometime after that, her husband told her the same thing. So he just did so. He just came to the conclusion that, and I think at some level she'd already known you know, that there is some problem. What she was trying to warn us of the kinds of changes that can occur when you look deeply within yourself and you discover truths that maybe you didn't want to see, but you surrender to what it is that the mind and your feelings is offering up. And so her warning to us was coming from a place of fear, you know, a fear of change. And Margaret Mead, I think, said one time, you know, the only people in this world who really want change are babies with wet diapers. Of course, that maybe wasn't taking into account people who live in oppressive societies and would just as soon have democracy. But at any rate, you know, that even for those who are living in oppressive conditions, sometimes there's a resistance to change. I guess coming out of that, on later retreats that I went on, and also retreats that I've taught since then, there's some kind of standard advice that we always give during the going home talk, as we call it. And usually it includes things like, within the first 10 days of coming home, don't go to work on Monday and tell your boss to take your job and shove it. Don't get married or divorced, you know, or don't buy and sell our home, although Luke may have begged to differ with me on that point, as much as he deals in real estate. But at any rate, what happens almost inevitably on one of these intensive residential meditation retreats, so when the mind gets really settled and deep and you begin to be more and more able to surrender to whatever the flow of experience is in the moment, you become more able to surrender to whatever it is that the mind is offering up that perhaps you have been repressing or not wanting to have a close look at, okay? That this form of surrender to change, the inevitability of change, it requires courage and it requires commitment. It requires respect for the process of your own spiritual growth. But the rewards of having done so are incalculable, because it's like the process of continuously breaking out of a shell. One of the similes the Buddha used, one of his discourses was called the snake shedding its skin. And he used this simile of, you know, that the snake and other reptiles, a serpent, they grow new skins all the time. They grow a new skin and it protects them and allows them to move over the ground and to get the job done, eat rodents and whatever, and dig a place to live and all that. And then at some point, it's kind of like, you know, getting your tires retreaded or something. You know, the skin wears out. It gets brittle and it's beat up and whatnot. And so the serpent has this ability to shed its skin and to grow a new one. And he likened continuous spiritual growth, continuous change, to that. He said, that's what we're doing all the time. We shed a skin that we no longer need so we can stay fresh and sensitive and responsive to the environment around us, so we can move around. And then at some point, over time, through use, that skin gets worn and brittle, and it's time to let it go, so you can grow the next one. And so, in that way, we can think of the process of spiritual growth, both as a process of continual rebirth and renewal, but also as a process of continuous grieving, because it's about death and rebirth happening at the same time. Really sweet book I like a lot by Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield, written about 30 years ago, called Seeking the Heart of Wisdom. And here's a passage from it. As our practice develops, the vision of impermanence deepens. We learn to acknowledge our aging and our death. We live more fully in the now. We can see through observation how our opinions, thoughts, feelings, and sensations all change so quickly. Jack Engler, a Harvard psychologist who has studied meditation, described the growth of wisdom as a process of grieving. Outwardly, our spiritual life brings us to acknowledge the temporality of life, to accept aging, death, and the temporary nature of even the most beloved people and experiences around us. As practice grows in us, our visions, our reflections, our hearts are required to come to terms with this. To come to terms with outer change at this level involves a tremendous process of letting go. Yet it is the task of all humans and an immediate necessity for anyone who would live with a wise heart in this world. So, to do this practice fully is to continuously let go. And at the same time, as we let go, to note what is the next thing that the mind is going to try to cling to, which of course then becomes the next thing that we might need to let go of. When I was living in the San Francisco Bay Area in the 1970s and 1980s, I was newly married, had a young daughter, was out of work, really freaked out, got a job through an employment and training act program, went to work for a nonprofit in Berkeley that was advocating for the rights of people with severe physical disabilities, Center for Independent Living, helped write some grants to get our legal shop established, got into a teaching law degree program at the University of California, Berkeley, and then gradually, during my time in graduate school, I felt this persona develop around me. You know, I was doing well in graduate school, I had a knack for the law, I was, you know, getting pats on the head and getting fellowships and whatnot, and eventually wrote a dissertation that became my first book on the water rights of American Indian tribes, and was as a doctoral student in, you know, pretty beefy graduate educational institution. Was kind of felt like I was sort of reaching the pinnacle of what was possible in that institutional environment, and had this pretty elaborately constructed sense of self around that. And then I graduated and managed to get a job as a, you know, low-ranked temporary instructor in a political science department teaching law at one of the branches of the University of California. And what I felt happening right after graduation, after having achieved this thing I've been working on all these years, was this sense of implosion and panic and fear. And it was around that time that Jack Kornfield had relocated into the Bay Area, and in addition to being a Dharma teacher, was also developing his practice as a psychotherapist. So I went to see Jack as a client, and said, "What the hell is going on here?" You know, I felt like I was at the absolute pinnacle, and now I feel like my life is disintegrated. I don't know who I am. I don't know what's next. And there was a real sense of fear and insecurity. And so we talked just about like cognitive therapy, just chill out. You know, you got a job. You're not going to be living in a cardboard box under the freeway. You know, you're going to be okay. And then he advised me to, he said, get a little flower vase and put a flower in it. Put it on your desk. And then just watch the flower day by day. And the teaching that he was offering in that exercise was the teaching of Anicca. It's a beautiful, fragrant flower in its little vase that's to be appreciated, you know, and honored, and then gradually it wilts and it loses its color and it loses its fragrance. And then it becomes compost. And then you put another flower, right? That was all. It was just, you know, it was the identity that you constructed around yourself. You know, great. You know, it was a vehicle. Helped get you where you needed to go. But it's exactly the same with the Dharma. The Buddha said this about his own teachings. He said, what I teach is not something to be clung to. He said, nothing whatsoever in this life, including my teachings, these precious teachings, is to be clung to as mine, as I or mine. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. These constructs, these things that we make use of are just that. They are things to make use of for a purpose. So we make use of the construct of a persona for a purpose. It's not who we are. The skin that the snake sheds is not the skin. It served a purpose. And so what Jack was telling me was the persona that you conjured up when you were in graduate school served a purpose. I got a job. I taught for a couple of years in the UC system. I was made a nice offer here at the University of Colorado. We moved to Colorado, and the whole process started all over again. Except instead of taking 6 years, it took 30 years, you know, to develop a career and write more books and get some awards and become known and all that good stuff, leading right up till June of 2016 when I retired from the faculty of the University of Colorado. And then the same damn thing had to happen all over again, right? It's like, well, duh, you know, I thought I'd learned that lesson back in 1984, but no, the same thing had happened again. This skin, this conjuring of a self, had occurred once more. And then yet again, it was only to be served a purpose, and now it's to be let go of. Okay. And so this teaching of Anicca, you know, this, I think, the more we accumulate life experience, the more powerful and profound the teaching becomes. You know, Reinhold Niebuhr, you know, and I think it was maybe, it was a quite a long time ago, he came up with this prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That's pretty solid Dharma. That's a Nietzsche. How do we find a way to make peace with inevitable change? How do we figure out how to skillfully work with those changes? Okay. In terms of the Dharma, basically, in my experience, that among the most important qualities of mind for us to cultivate are equanimity and compassion. They both arise from the insight into the nature of change and the experience of things as they are. So like in our culture, when I was back in the 70s when we were living in the Bay Area, my wife and I helped establish an organization called the Shanti Project. And it was to provide counseling and companionship for people with life-threatening illnesses, who in fact maybe pretty soon be getting ready to die. And one of the tropes that it was dominant then and it continues to be now with people with life-threatening illness, especially illnesses such as some cancers, you know, we find the news media using over and over phrases like battling cancer, you know, and oh, he lost his struggle with cancer, you know, as if living with a life-threatening illness was some kind of heroic challenge that either in partnership with Western medicine you are going to overcome, or that, you know, as sometimes happens with hero myths, you succumb, you know. And undoubtedly, I've known many people who were afflicted with various cancers and who had to undergo all kinds of therapies. They require a lot of courage and a lot of fortitude and a lot of consistency to deal with. But there is also a shadow side to that trope, because then if whatever those treatments are, whatever the efforts are not turning out to be successful, then there's a sense of failure that somehow or another, you know, if I had done something different, or if I'd caught this earlier, or if I only went for another round of chemo, then things ought to be all right. There is an alternative model, you know. I have two acquaintances in the last few years who've gone out on a glioblastoma, which is a particularly aggressive form of brain cancer. And both of them, this is a short one-way street for the most part. And the tropes were off for battling, you know, radical surgery and this and that. And at some point they both said, you know, I'm less concerned about how many more days of life I have on this earth than I am in what they consist of. What the quality of mind on a moment-to-moment basis is instead. Close friend of my wife's, my wife Abby is a nurse midwife, and for many years was on the faculty of the University of Colorado Nursing School, where she trained graduate nursing students to become midwives. And her start in the profession came from this real kind of legendary figure in Colorado nurse midwifery. And she and friends in that practice have stayed close friends over the years. And about 3 years ago, this person started to experience problems with motor, controlling motor functions of the hands and the feet, and it gradually became worse, and so she got treated and diagnosed and whatnot, and only over time did it become evident that she had ALS, and that she was going down with it, and she was going down at a pretty good clip. And this was someone who had spent her entire life creating institutions and leading and bringing, you know, being a leader in the training of people to bring new life into the world. And now she was progressively losing the ability even to control what was left of her own life. And just incalculable dukkha accompanying that. And so what Abby did was to form a sangha, a sitting group, around her friend, because she had kept asking questions of Abby about the Dharma and whatnot. So for about the last year or so, there has been this little sitting group that's formed around this person, as her body has continued to rapidly deteriorate, and she has lost one function after another. So I've been privileged to teach the Dharma from time to time in the sitting group. And it's a little bit like when I was, and Don and I both have taught out at the Federal Men's Correctional Institute, the medium security federal men's prison at down in Englewood. And when you would go meet with the inmate sangha, and you start talking about dukkha, they knew what you were talking about. You didn't have to speak in theoretical terms. They were right there. They were listening intently. They would share their own experiences because they lived dukkha on a day-to-day basis. It was, in fact, their life. And so it was a little bit like that with Abby's friend. You know, it's like that she just soaks up the Dharma like a sponge. And, you know, we have these, we talk about these stages of, you know, facing life-threatening illness, like denial and bargaining and anger and despair and acceptance and all that, you know. And they're taught as if there's some kind of linear progression. First one, then the next, and then the next. For those of us that have been working with this stuff for a while, we know it's not like that. Any of them can pop up at any time, you know. But one of the things that is happening with our friend that I didn't see any of at the very beginning of this sitting group is from time to time this real sense of equanimity. The sense of acceptance. This is how it is. Okay. It's not as if I'm going to make this ALS go away. It's not as if I'm going to be able to change the course of its progression. Okay. But just as the Buddha said, the change that is possible is the change of my relationship to the experience. And the way the change in the relationship to the experience occurs is through letting go. This is how it is. Okay. There are things I can do in my life still, my relationship with my family, various things just having to do with day-to-day care. But mostly, the only thing I can really change in my life is to stop fighting the fact that this is happening. And to stop living in anguish and in conflict with what is real and how it is. And I have been touched and moved by the effects that I have seen the Dharma have on her as those understandings have gone in deeper and deeper. There's a peacefulness and an openness about her that I never experienced when I first got to know her a few years ago. And for me, it's kind of a living example of what this practice is capable of. And moreover, of what we are capable of. She had no knowledge of the Dharma whatsoever a year ago. And now it's changed her life. And in the evidence of the way it's changed her life, it's also changed the life of all of us around her. You know, just being part of that transformation and witnessing that, personally for me, as well as the folks I know that went out, you know, with brain cancer, it's like saying, wow, that's possible. That's possible for me too. It's possible for all of us. You know, I've known several people over the course of my life who have experienced life-threatening illnesses like cancer, some of whom survived it and some of whom didn't. But one of the more common things they've told me is that I can't exactly say I'm grateful for having had this affliction, this disease happen. But what I can say is that it opened me to aspects of my own being that I did not know existed, that I did not know were there. And it's made me into someone who is more trusting of my own capacity for spiritual growth than I ever thought possible. And I've gone and run the clock. I'm sorry we don't have time for some discussion, but when I'm next here, we can pick up where we left off. If we could please just take one moment, settle in, regain our sitting postures, allow the eyes to gently close, the attention to come to rest on our breathing. May we live with ease and know ease of well-being. May we be safe from all inner and outer harm. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart. May we rest in the dedication and compassion. An acceptance of things as they are that we share with all living beings. For this is who we truly are. May we trust it and rest in our own true nature. Thank you for being here tonight. Have a safe journey home.